Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the second part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that'll be followed by some information on Google censorship and an upcoming event. I know that many of the listeners know that what we've been told about 9/11 is a total fabrication. And it's important to keep in mind that the event of 9/11 is what has been used to allow the government to falsely justify its attacks on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria through its bogus global war on terror. While pretending to resist Al-Qaeda and ISIS, it has been well documented that the U.S. and its allies are actually funding, supporting, and arming these proxy armies. And to get us started with today's show, I'm going to share with you first the two-minute segment by General Wesley Clark talking about his visit to the Pentagon right after 9/11. Stephen Gowans references Wesley Clark's statements right at the beginning of this part of his speech. So here's General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me in. He said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
And now, here's Stephen Gowans.
Let's jump to 2001, the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. The retired U.S. Army General Wesley Clark told a reporter that during a trip to the Pentagon, he learned of plans the Pentagon had developed to attack a number of countries in the Arab and Muslim worlds. One was Iraq, which was soon attacked. Another was Libya, which was eventually attacked. And a third was Syria. In 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil hit list, this regime hit list. Washington claimed that Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction and sponsoring terrorism. This was the same bogus charge it had leveled against Iraq as a pretext to topple the Arab nationalist government in Baghdad and to privatize an Iraqi economy, which Washington denounced as socialist, and was indeed, to a large degree, publicly owned and planned. Iraq had combined its oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy to produce what one former U.S. State Department official had called the Golden Age. He wrote, "Schools, universities, hospitals, factories, theaters, museums proliferated. Employment became so universal that a labor shortage developed." The same former U.S. State Department official wrote about Gaddafi in Libya, that by combining Libya's oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy, Gaddafi had enabled Libyans to, quote, live beyond the dreams of their fathers and grandfathers. In 2003, this is not widely known, but it is certainly not concealed on the public record, but in 2003, following the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, the United States contemplated extending military operations in Iraq to Syria, but decided that its hands were filled with the pacification of Afghanistan and the difficulties it was encountering in the resistance in Iraq, and that it would have to achieve its regime change goals for Syria by other means. The first alternative to direct military intervention was to impose broad-ranging sanctions on Syria to do what sanctions are always intended to do, destroy economies. Destroy economies in order to make life so miserable for ordinary people that they rise up and overthrow their government. In a country as large as the United States, which has such an enormous impact on the global economy, is able to destroy the economies of small countries like Syria. Sanctions are also useful for propaganda purposes, because once you've destroyed a country's economy, you can attribute its economic difficulties to its failure to follow your economic policy prescriptions. To say, if you had adopted free trade, free markets, free enterprise, you would have been a prosperous economy, but you didn't do so. That's why your economy is suffering, of course, without mentioning the devastating impacts of sanctions. The sanctions, as intended, devastated Syria. In October 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy, quote, was buckling under the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had, quote, forced Syrian officials to stop providing education, healthcare, and other essential services in some parts of Syria. By 2016, according to a leaked internal UN report, US and EU sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary people and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn, who writes for The Independent, likened the sanctions imposed on Syria to sanctions that had been imposed on Iraq from the early 1990s to 2003. Those sanctions, according to a UN estimate, had led to the deaths through malnutrition and disease of at least 500,000 children. More deaths than had been produced by all the weapons of mass destruction in history. As a result, two political scientists, John and Carl Mueller, had called the sanctions of mass destruction, more devastating than the atomic bombs that had been dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, more devastating than all the mustard gas used in the First World War. In effect, the United States had taken measures equivalent to dropping two atomic bombs on Iraq. Largely unrecognized is that sanctions of this caliber have been destroying Syria for the last 14 years. You know, we see attacks carried out by Washington's proxy guerrilla armies. We see the beheadings, we see the eviscerations, we see the barbecuing of heads, we see the suicide bombings, but what we don't see are the invisible but equally, if not more, destructive effects of sanctions. Significantly, the moment sanctions were lifted on a defeated Arab nationalist Iraq in 2003, they were immediately imposed on an unbowed Arab nationalist Syria. Which means that from the early 1990s to 2017, for the last quarter century, the United States and its allies have waged a highly destructive campaign of economic warfare, the commercial equivalent of a nuclear attack, first on Iraq, subsequently on Syria. And why? Why have they done this? Because they're opposed to the Arab nationalist efforts to bring the economies of the Arab world under the control of people who live and work in the Arab world. Well, sanctions constituted the first means by which regime change was to be brought about. The second was to ignite or reignite the Islamist war on the Syrian state. The Islamist war that had been more or less quelled by 1982. But in 2006, Syria's Muslim Brotherhood had at least two meetings at the White House, according to the Wall Street Journal. In 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood helped found the National Salvation Front. The Front met frequently with the U.S. State Department, with the National Security Council, as well as with the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative. In late 2010, just a few months, in fact, December 2010, just a few months before riots were to erupt in the Syrian city of Dara, marking the beginning of what would become known as the Arab Spring in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood voiced its hope for a civil revolt to oust Assad's so-called heretical government. Well, the hope that a civil revolt would soon erupt was realized only a few short months later, an outcome that the United States and Muslim Brotherhood had been working on since 2006. But in early 2011, before the uprising in Dara, as upheaval swept across the Arab world, all was quiet in Syria. And this perplexed Western news organizations. I mean, there were demonstrations in Tunisia. There were demonstrations in Egypt. There was an uprising in Libya, but not the slightest evidence of distemper in Syria. So the New York Times and Time magazine dispatched reporters to find out what made Syria different. And here's what they reported. They said all was quiet in Syria because the government had broad support. They said all was quiet in Syria because even critics concede that Assad is popular. They said all is quiet in Syria because Assad has, and this is Time magazine, has endeared himself to the population, especially youth, the segment of the population from which rebellion was expected to spring, if indeed rebellion materialized. They said all is quiet in Syria because attempts to organize protests against the government had failed. Syrians, they said, felt no compulsion to protest against their government. And you can confirm all of this yourself. It's quite easy to do. Just go to the Internet archives of the New York Times or Time magazine for the months January, February, March, and April 2011 and read the stories on Syria. Well, in mid-March 2011, riots broke out in Dara. They were violent. Some rioters carried arms. Buildings were burned. Vehicles were set fire to on the street. Even U.S. officials, according to the New York Times, quote, acknowledged that the demonstrations weren't peaceful and that some protesters were armed. In the mythology that would later develop about the origins of the post-2011 or post-2010 conflict, this became the protests were largely peaceful, which I guess is another way of saying they're violent, but a way of putting it so it seems like they're peaceful. Eventually, the modifier largely was dropped altogether so that the story became the demonstrations were peaceful. And you can hear many people tell you today with great certitude that the demonstrations were peaceful without offering the slightest evidence to show how it is that these were peaceful. A week after the outbreak of violence in Dara, Time reported that there do not appear to be widespread calls for the fall of the regime or the removal of the relatively popular president. Well, that clashes with the narrative, the mythology that would be subsequently developed. Over a month after the outbreak of violence and rioting in Dara, the New York Times' Anthony Shadid would report, quote, the protests fall short of popular upheaval of revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. Significantly, Time magazine would report that Islam was playing a significant role in the protests. So, if you look back over the long war on Syria, what do you have? You have civil disturbances fomented by Islamists dating to the 1960s. You have an Islamist guerrilla warfare, or guerrilla war, dating to the 1970s, culminating in the violent takeover of Hama in 1982. You have Islamists meeting with the White House, with the State Department, with the National Security Council from 2006, after Washington decides or abandons plans for direct military intervention in Syria. And we have Islam, according to Time magazine, playing a prominent role in the protests, which are violent and involve arms. Consistent with this, in 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, one of a number of intelligence agencies in the U.S. intelligence community, reveals that the insurgency is Islamist and led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forerunner of ISIS. So you have indication after indication that the uprising was not a peaceful, secular movement for democracy, but a renewal of Syria's decades-long civil war between Islamists and secularists, egged on by the United States and U.S. allies. Indeed, the Defense Intelligence Agency said that the insurgents were supported by the West, that they were supported by the West's allies in the Gulf and by Turkey. There are a number of other reasons to conclude that the uprising had nothing whatever to do with the pursuit of a secular liberal democracy. First, the Swedish Institute of International Affairs had observed that virtually all the members of the various armed insurgents groups are Sunni Arabs. The fighting has largely been restricted to Sunni Arab areas, whereas areas inhabited by Alawis, Druze, and Christians are passive or supportive of the government. Defections from the state are almost 100% Sunni. Money, arms, and volunteers pour in from the Islamic states or from pro-Islamic organizations. And, this is the Institute, religion is the insurgent movement's most important common denominator. So if this rebellion was guided by secular, liberal, democratic goals, why are Alawis, Druze, and Christians not participating? Second, the Assad government amended the country's constitution in response to the uprising to allow multi-candidate presidential elections. It also suspended the security law, which is the Syrian equivalent of our War Measures Act. The security law had been invoked for a number of reasons, not least of which is that Syria remains officially at war with Israel, and Israel illegally occupies Syrian territory on the Golan Heights. These concessions, in the direction of liberal democracy, were immediately rejected by the insurgents and by their supporters. Instead, the insurgency heated up, despite the fact that Syria now more closely approximated the paradigm of multi-candidate or multi-party representative democracy favored by the West than virtually any other Arab country, and certainly more so than the allies or the Arab allies of the United States, which are all military and royal dictatorships. Third point, this is a tart observation made by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He said, you know, we started helping the rebels, whoever they are, and they're certainly not fighting for democracy given their sponsorship, Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Well, he might have added, they're certainly not fighting for democracy given that their main sponsor is the United States, which promotes not democracy, but U.S. business interests. The late Middle East specialist Patrick Seale wrote that the Syrian uprising should be seen as only the latest, if by far the most violent, episode in a long war between Islamists and Ba'athists, which dates back to the founding of the secular Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party in the 1940s. It's not inspired by liberal democratic goals. I mean, it's inspired on the part of the insurgents by Islamic goals and sectarian goals, and on the part of the United States by neo-colonial goals. At the same time, the veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn wrote not too long ago that Washington has always wanted to get rid of Assad, not since 2011 when Obama told Assad that he needed to step down, from 2000 when Assad became president, just as Washington has always wanted to get rid of his father, who they viewed as an Arab communist. So, you know, the United States and sectarian Sunni political Islam formed an alliance of convenience to eliminate a common enemy from the Syrian state. But it should be emphasized, the enemy is not Assad. It's not Assad alone. I mean, the standard operating procedure of U.S. campaigns of regime change is to reduce government's Washington abhors to a single individual who can be demonized as a Hitler or branded a brutal dictator or an animal, as Trump calls Assad, or a moral disgrace, as Noam Chomsky calls Assad, and so on. But the enemy is not the individual. If Assad were to step down today and leave in his place a successor who also espoused Arab nationalist values, the war would continue. Indeed, when the Ba'ath Arab Socialist Saddam was driven from power in Iraq, the military dictator Washington installed in Iraq, initially, Paul L. Bremer, what was his act number one? Act number one was debathification of the state. That is, removing from the Iraqi state every secular Arab nationalist. Washington then effectively imposed a constitution on Iraq, which bars forever secular Arab nationalists from holding places in the Iraqi government or Iraqi state. So the objective of Washington's long war in Iraq was the debathification of the Iraqi state. The objective of Washington's long war in Syria is the debathification of the Syrian state. So let me close on this. So a year after, Muammar Gaddafi, inspired by the Arab nationalist goals of unity, freedom, and socialism, was removed from power by Islamists backed by NATO. The Wall Street Journal revealed, and this always happens, it seems, you know, about a year after some event, you can read in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times what was really going on. The Wall Street Journal revealed that Western companies had, or oil companies had, agitated for Gaddafi's removal because he was driving hard bargains with Western oil companies and insisting that Libyans benefit from their own oil resources. The State Department complained that this was resource nationalism. Well, you know, U.S. oil companies believe that the petroleum resources of the Arab and Muslim world should be used for the enrichment of their shareholders. But there's a systemic reason for that. They're supposed to behave that way. In their view, the shareholders come first. These resources aren't to be used for the benefit of people who live in the region. Gaddafi had the very opposite view, and as a result, he was eliminated. So, a day before this book went to press, I read a short essay by a notable Canadian, Norman Bethune. The essay was titled Wounds. Bethune, for those of you who don't know, and not everyone knows who Bethune was a skilled and innovative surgeon who was at the forefront of the struggle for public health care in Canada. But he's perhaps best known for participating in two wars in the late 1930s. The first was the Spanish Civil War. The second was the Second Sino-Japanese War. In the Second Sino-Japanese War, Bethune joined Mao's forces as a frontline surgeon in the resistance against Japanese efforts to colonize China. It was in China that Bethune wrote his essay. And his essay was a meditation on the causes of war in which he was entangled, which produced the wounds that he was called upon every day to operate on. And as I read the essay, it struck me that what Bethune was saying in a very few words was what I had struggled in a whole book to say. So I quickly asked my publisher if he could include a short quote from Wounds as the epigraph of the book, which he readily agreed to. So let me read you the epigraph. Are wars of aggression, wars for the conquest of colonies, just big business? Yes, would seem so, however much the perpetrators of such national crimes seek to hide their purpose under banners of high-sounding abstractions and ideals. Today, the high-sounding abstractions and ideals are expressed in the claim that the West has a moral obligation to act, that we have a responsibility to protect, that we cannot stand idly by, and so on. The most insightful part of Bethune's essay, in my view, is the last paragraph. So he wrote, what do these enemies of the human race look like? And he's referring to those who, in the hunt for profit, start the wars which create the wounds that he's called upon to heal. Do they wear on their foreheads a sign so they may be told, so they may be shunned and condemned as criminals? No. On the contrary, they are the respectable ones. They are the pillars of the state, they are the pillars of the church, they are the pillars of society. They support private and public charity out of the excess of their wealth. They endow institutions. In their private lives, they are kind and considerate. But there's one sign by which these gentlemen can be told. Threaten a reduction in their profits, and the beast in them awakens with a snarl. They become ruthless as savages, brutal as madmen, ruthless as executioners. And when you read in the Wall Street Journal that Western oil companies had complained to the U.S. State Department that something had to be done about the Arab nationalist Gaddafi, who threatened a reduction in their oil profits, it's hard not to think of the pillars of society and respectable people of whom Bethune wrote. Well, Bethune ended his essay with this. Such an organization of human society as permits them to exist must be abolished. And the overarching theme of this book is this: Washington's long war in Syria can only be understood within the context of the organization of human society as permits these enemies of humanity to exist. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to the final part of a recent speech given by author Stephen Gowans. His latest book is called Washington's Long War on Syria, published by Baraka Books. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now, let's take a brief look at Google censorship. Here's a short clip from RT that exposes it.
Well, Google announced changes to its algorithm search last April, aiming to combat so-called fake news and conspiracy theories. In a blog post, a company executive said the technology would change its search rankings to help surface more authoritative pages and demote low-quality content. But according to my next guest, some believe this new algorithm is doing more than filtering out fake news. Andre Demin, reporter for the World Socialist website, thank you so much for joining us today. So before the election, many on the right were complaining that conservative articles were not coming up on Google searches, and now we're hearing something similar from the other side of the aisle. So you believe that the website you work for in particular is being targeted?
Yes, and among a whole series of left-wing, progressive, and anti-war websites. We have found, using our research based on the Amazon Alexa search tool and ratings tool, that the rankings and traffic of many left-wing websites have plummeted after Google implemented a new search algorithm, which was announced in that blog post you referenced on April 25th. And that had a tremendous impact on the amount of traffic, according to a number of websites that we've spoken to, coming from Google to progressive websites and left-wing websites. And yes, the World Socialist website was certainly affected.
And in terms of the right or left, regardless of political affiliation, should Google be in the business of determining what's fake news? And is this an infringement of freedom of speech, or is this a way to really help to stop spreading misinformation all over the place?
Well, we think that Google has no business in deciding what political viewpoints can and cannot be presented to users. If a user searches any topic on a political question, he or she should have a wide range of viewpoints that are presented to them. But the vision that was outlined in the April 25th document explaining the changes to Google's algorithm is something completely different. It envisions Google becoming a censorship engine rather than a search engine, in which it has a whole series of internal guidelines with evaluators, which are a little more effectively than censors, who decide what is real and what is fake, what news should be presented and what news should not be presented. And the effect is that people's opinions, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, which is one of the most politically connected corporations on the planet, having given more in lobbying donations over the recent period than any other corporation, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, if they don't line up with the interests of the government, if they don't line up with the interests of the military and intelligence establishment, they will be censored. And the vision outlined in that document is entirely consistent with the statistics that we've seen.
So there's pretty serious censorship going on as the corporate media giants lose control of the message they're told to deliver. I hope you'll use other search engines, and we can only hope they're not involved in the censorship too. And now for the event. It will be on Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar in Hartford. It's at 494A Farmington Avenue. The Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group will be showing the first part of the film Incontrovertible at the Juicy J's Juice Bar at 7 p.m. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th. So come and join us for some healthy food and drink from the Juicy J Juice Bar and see this incredible film that presents the evidence that explodes the official story of 9/11. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar, 494A Farmington Avenue in Hartford at 7 p.m. And that concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.